Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation with Tom Merritt and Leo Laporte. Episode 32, recorded November 16th, 2011. Scott Sigler. Triangulation is brought to you by Ford, featuring Wi-Fi connectivity with available sync and MyFord Touch. Now your car could be a Wi-Fi hotspot. Check it out in the new 2012 Ford Focus and at Ford.com/technology. And by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, visit Netflix.com/TWiT. It's time for Triangulation, the show in which Tom Merritt and I pick a poor lost soul and grill him until he breaks into tears. Actually, that's never happened yet.
Not yet.
But we do.
And I don't think it's going to happen with this guy.
We do like to pick smart, interesting people and talk about the world at large. And Tom, this one's all yours because I've known Scott for a long time. He was a proto-podcaster. Science fiction author or author. Is that fair to qualify?
More like modern day thriller.
Thriller.
With a science
thrillers.
Background, yeah.
Yeah, science-y thrillers.
Mm-hmm.
Science thrillers.
It's science and fiction.
And thrillers.
Yes, it's science and fiction.
They're not true.
Partially.
They're only
to the best of your knowledge.
Anyway, welcome Scott Sigler to a guy we should have had on Triangulation a long time ago. Because, you know, many ways you're a pioneer. In fact, with this new Google Music announcement, I'm very curious what Scott has to say about this. Scott podcasted his novels at first, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, March 2005, right when podcasting, I mean, TWiT started around that same time, Buzz Out Loud.
It was the beginning of podcasting,
time.
Yeah.
You did what was probably, at least as far as we know, the first podcast of a book.
You read your books.
Yeah, there were three of us kind of stumbled onto it simultaneously, Mark Jeffries, T. Morris, and myself. They were podcasting books they already had out. I was fortunate enough to be the first one to do a podcast-only book. It was only being released weekly in podcast form.
So were you writing it and then recording it and then releasing it?
No, this
it was already
done. This is a completely done book. It was supposed to be out from AOL Time Warner in 2002. The imprint got scrapped, so the book kind of reverted back to me. By 2005, I hadn't found another publishing deal. So I learned about podcasting and started releasing the book in weekly episodes, about 25, 30 minutes each. And the book was called Earth Core, and it caught fire a little bit, and people really enjoyed it. And then that started a sequence of building a larger and larger audience until I was able to put out print books and could see what would happen to those.
Now, did Time Warner change their mind and say, oh, well, it's doing well on a podcast. We'll put it out after all. What was the route back to getting print?
The route back was, I remember when I learned about podcasting, and then I started looking, like, this would be a great way to deliver an audiobook. It'll be just like the radio dramas of the 40s and 50s. I went looking for a bunch to listen to online, couldn't find any, and the light bulb went off. I'm like, oh, I could be the first of this and get some notoriety and get some publicity out of it. And then when it started to roll and I started to get, you know, 4 and then 5 digits worth of people listening to it each week, I was like, oh, as soon as I show this to New York publishing houses, they're going to go nuts and start throwing money at me.
Mm-hmm.
And when my agent, who didn't understand it and was upset I was screwing
you're giving
up the
it
audio
away.
Rights.
You're giving it away.
He's like, you're giving it away. You'll screw up our audio rights.
You're crazy.
When we went to New York, they were just absolutely oblivious. The publishing industry is doing a much better job with the internet now, but in 2005.
No idea.
No idea.
Were you aware of Paulo Coelho and what he had done to make his book successful, and it's not with podcasting, but giving them away and building a community and raising awareness. The Alchemist really was, you know, kind of spread worldwide that way. Were you aware at the time of what he had done?
No, at the time, the only person I was really aware of was Cory Doctorow.
Cory has the same idea.
Cory was giving away his books free as PDFs.
Right.
I was able to look at that and use that as a template for all. If I give this away as audio,
still
it'll
must
be great.
Be scary.
It really wasn't, because I'd been banging away trying to get a publishing deal for about 12 years,
and then
I'd had one and it had slipped away.
So you had nothing to lose.
It wasn't that I had nothing to lose. It was just as soon as I saw it, I'm like, this is going to be a significant thing for fiction, because if you want to build an audience and then people can instant message the link, their friend clicks it and they're listening to the audio right away. Message boards, chat rooms, email, blogs. All I saw was a way to get potentially thousands of people trying my stuff out for free, and then out of that, a certain percentage would like it and go from there. So I was fired up for it from day one.
If Time Warner had gone ahead and published it,
mm-hmm. you'd be
screwed. What are the chances are that you still would have gone ahead and tried some of this stuff? I mean, I'm not saying it was born of desperation, but you did have the flexibility because nobody was publishing it.
Right.
But you seem like the kind of guy who would have wanted to do this sort of thing anyway.
It's really difficult to look back and say.
At
that point, I would have been going on my third year with one of the big six publishers, and it depends on how sales were. As far as I know, I could have been like, I'm not giving away any of my stuff for free, right. Stupid pirates, and now
I love
pirates.
Well, that's why you can't blame a lot of authors and musicians and everybody else who kind of say, oh, God, I don't, because they have something to lose. And it's really people like you who there's only upside.
Yeah.
For you, who can invent this new stuff? Mm-hmm. It was kind of the same for Twit. I mean, we had nothing to lose. I wasn't going to undermine any existing business, mm-hmm. and that's why we can do what we do. But CNN is having a hard time doing it because they have a business they can undermine.
Right. Well, as a storyteller, it's and you're trying to break into the business and you're trying to build up an audience. At the time, there were these things called the bookstores. I don't know if you guys remember these, but they were buildings.
Yeah, I used to work at one. Yeah.
Yeah.
They had ice cream, right?
And they had coffee and things. It was strange. But if somebody walks into a bookstore and I'm fortunate enough to be published and they see my book on a shelf and it's on the same shelf as Stephen King because they're both horror, odds are no one's going to pick up my book at all. But if it's available online and they go, oh, this is free, I can give this a listen.
Right.
They try me out and they say they like me. So it was nothing but upside from square one. I'm still very sold on it.
Do you still give away?
Yep.
And why do you still do it now? Because now you've gotten a little more name recognition.
I still give away. I've given away every word I have written, unabridged, free.
Wow.
And continue
Creative
to do that.
Creative Commons? How do you do it?
Yeah, we do it Creative Commons. Yeah. We'll continue and Crown, my publisher, which is Division of Random House, is totally down with it. They're happy with it.
Good
so
for Crown.
It Crown's very forward thinking in a lot of the stuff they do. They're a great partner. And all they know is that the books continue to sell two or three years after they've been out. Where normally books will, of course, there's a peak, then they'll drop off, and then there's a serious drop off. Mine have kind of stayed at that middle level because people are still discovering it because it's free. Then they go out and buy the books.
So it's no longer an act of faith. There's metrics to prove this mm-hmm. is viable. This works.
It's advertising. That is my form of advertising.
Yeah. So this is a hard metric that says even though I'm giving it away for free, it is in fact pirated, except not pirated because you're okay with it. Mm-hmm. I am making more money than I probably would have otherwise. You can relatively securely say that. Whereas the industry is out there saying over and all, pirates are losing us millions and millions of dollars. Do you, since you experienced the opposite, do you think they're full of crap?
They're totally full of crap. Well, you got to understand big publishing's perspective. You've got your Stephen King's and Danielle Steele's, and you've got Twilight. People want to go get those things, and they may pirate those things when they would otherwise pay for them. But it's such an infinitesimally small amount. For the most part, pirates are discovering stuff that there's no way they would have even heard of or paid for at all. And I'm a firm believer that no one minds paying money for a product. People don't care. They'll pay money for a product if they really like it. If they go get something for free and then discover, oh, this stuff is fantastic, this is exactly what I like, they're more apt to go out and pay for it after that.
Why do you think people buy your books when they could get them for free? I think that's what always throws people. When the,
right.
the common sense argument is, right. like, well, why would anyone ever do that? How is it that people buy the print book when they can download it for free?
Well, there's two parts to that. The first part is because of the podcast, and I have my 4 minutes of fury before every episode where I talk about what's going on in my author life. That develops a connection.
So they pay not to hear that.
There are people who do pay not to hear that, absolutely. There's a connection with the audience, and they are... The hardcore fans are very entertained, and they're right. happy to support.
You're
in
building
any way.
Community.
Yeah, building community. They're happy to support in any way that they can. But I think what people miss is the concept is, well, if they listen to that for free, they're not buying it. But what they're missing is how much bigger the pie gets because people are listening for free. And out of that, out of those people who would never otherwise listen to me, a certain percentage of them become diehard fans, and then they want to be the people who support everything I do and buy everything that I put out.
Do you think it works better with some genres? I mean, I think that this genre, you know, the science fiction thriller, the science thriller, the Michael Crichton genre, mm-hmm. breeds absolute fandom, you know? I'm not sure that nonfiction, you know, history would. So is it the genre, you know, I think often think that because we're in tech, Twit could do this, mm-hmm. but if we were gardening, it would be very difficult to be viable. Do you think it's the genre that makes this possible?
Right now, I think genre matters. The e-books, e-book sales are outside of the New York Times bestsellers are dominated by science fiction
right.
because
there
the people who get tech, the people who, like, when I started out podcasting in 2005, 2006, it was a lot of engineers and programmers.
You had to be a geek.
Yeah,
it was so hard to do.
You had to be a geek to get it.
So I think, kind of.
I do think genre matters, but I think that that's rapidly changing. Right. I think the next thing that's going to blow up is romance. Somebody's going to be doing romance fiction. Mm-hmm.
That is a genre, though, where people are devoted. And
yes.
And you look at Twilight or you look at these bodice rippers. They're devoted. They mm-hmm. buy them all. And the reason I think that that's valuable is people might listen to your whole book on the podcast, but they want to own it.
Yeah.
They want this. And I think that you need the kind of fan who wants to hold the book.
So you have the fans that want to support you. You have the fans that want to have the object.
Yeah, they're so in love with
it. Do you think that you get fans from word of mouth, too, who hear somebody who read the free PDF? They never even listened to your podcast. They just read it, and they say, oh, I love this. And they hear the story, and they go out and they buy the print version, or maybe they buy the ebook version from Kindle or something.
Well, that's another big factor. And like you said, Leo, people want that memento on their bookshelf. Yeah. I entertained the crap out of me. I want to be able to look at it and see it, because there's nothing to touch with digital audio book,
right?
Yeah, I do that.
But as far as word of mouth, that's the other thing that's a huge factor. And people are all down on piracy and think free is stupid. But even the people who go get my book, maybe even pirate my book or listen to it for free, and they're never going to buy another book, they have a social circle that they talk to. And if they enjoy it, they're going to go out and talk to 3, 4, 5 people who are like-minded with them because they're in the same culture. And they're going to say, oh, I heard this great book by Scott Sigler. You should check it out. Some of those people would just rather go buy the book because it's easier than to go through all the rigmarole. So, yeah, even though it's being pirated and given away free, there's a secondary exposure of the people that pirate talks to, and out of them you're going to wind up with a couple paying customers that, again, you would have never, ever had if it wasn't available for free.
I've often heard Cory Doctorow talk about these same issues and wondered, when we get to the point where everybody's reading their things on Kindle and they're reading their things electronically, will the economics change? Will it be that giving it away free is no longer encouraging people because they're not as likely to want to go pay for the book in all cases? You'll still have some people who want to collect. But do you think that
there'll be no difference in
once we've
the final
made that
medium.
Change where, you know, maybe 10 years down the road, everybody's buying online, will they
right.
still want to pay for things when they could get it for free?
Some people will still want to pay for it because they want to patronize that artist.
That's what I think. And I think that's the transition we have to make. It's to patronage. You know, the Honor Harrington series, which is a 13-book science fiction series, Steve Gibson's fanatic about it. The author has also done the same thing, PDFs. In fact, the first volume I downloaded is a PDF. But I think I'm much more likely to, even though I'm reading it on the Kindle, so just for functionally, it's no difference buying or taking it for free. Mm-hmm. It ends up the same way. But I think that it's patronage. And I do think it's important that there's some education, that people understand that artists don't work for free. If you want them to continue to create their art, whether it's a musician, a movie maker, or a writer, you got to patronize them. There's that patronage system. And that's an old system. Look at the Medicis. I mean, it's not really a new idea. But maybe it's a more wholesome idea than the system that we had of intermediaries, of publishers, mm-hmm. and that whole system, which I think is really relatively modern.
It becomes a meritocracy to some extent. You have my stuff is available for free in so many places. I have to write stories that are so good that people are like, I have to give something for that because I enjoyed that so much. And the goal is whatever the price. My goal as an author is whatever the price point. I want someone to buy it and say I would have paid more for that than I actually paid for it. But yeah, you're always gonna have some people who just want to listen to it for free, which is part of my model, though. I've got a lot of college students who are listening, people in their early 20s right now struggling to find a job. They know that I have stuff out for them every week, don't have to worry about it.
Yeah. Right.
And sometimes you get this email like, I wish I could buy your stuff. I'm like, don't worry about it. Someday you'll be able to if you want to. And then you're again, building fan base.
Or are you building a devoted fan base when you do stuff?
Yeah. I actually had some guy download my book for free and pay me in WoW by sending me some like high level items for my character.
That's great.
Like, I can't afford it.
I'll take that.
I was like, this is great.
That's some gold.
You know, purple level pants. That's awesome.
How'd you like to be a mage?
Yeah.
Let me send you my mage pants.
I think the system has something to do with it too. I find myself I've bought some things in the Kindle store that I know I could have gotten for free legally. Mm-hmm. But because I was in the store and I didn't want to go download it and plug in the USB, I can just press a button. I mean, making it frictionless, making it easy. I think that is undervalued in the system.
All right. I'm going to throw a monkey wrench into this, though. Because then there are going to be people who say, okay, that's fine because you're a wildly appealing author. You write books that are accessible that people love. What about an author who might have something important to say but isn't going to be beloved, isn't going to be as accessible? How do they find an audience? How do they find a voice? Doesn't it kind of reward the populist people and kind of disincent the people who might have something less popular to say?
I don't think so, because the people who have something less popular to say, or, you know, I assume we're talking from a political perspective, they're going to get fans who are also passionate about them. I think the great leveling force of the internet is, no matter what you are writing or talking about, if it's a really well-produced piece of work, there's somebody out there who's going to read it and listen to it, who's going to go, oh my God, this is the greatest thing ever.
And all you need
is
1,000.
You got 1,000. And now you've got someone who's out there selling for you.
Right.
So I think it's available to fiction, nonfiction, all genres, all angles. It's only good for authors. It's only good for musicians, because now you have the potential to reach a global population at the speed of light, and those people have the ability to pass on the content to their friends, again, just like that. And that's something we've never had before. I've been telling all, when I talk to other authors and aspiring authors, I'm like, this is the greatest time in the history of mankind to be an author, and probably a musician. I don't follow
any
that as
creative.
Well.
Any creative. I would say any creative.
Yeah.
Because the tools have become affordable, and the distribution has become democratized. But I notice you got a publisher now.
Yes.
Why?
Well, I got that deal in 2007. I had put out Earthcore and Ancestor as the free podcast, in fact, in a book called The Rookie. And when we put out Ancestor as a paperback from Dragon Moon Press, small press in Canada, it was the number one horror novel, number one sci-fi novel on Amazon in print. This is before the Kindle action was going. And that got New York very excited about the potential, and I had a new agent with the books on different desks. And my goal had been, since I was probably 13, I wanted a print deal. I wanted hardcover books. Wanted to be in stores. So we got that deal, and it went into auction, and it was a great deal. And that allowed me to go full-time at the writing. So what will be interesting is the fourth book is called Nocturnal. Fourth book I have with Crown. It's a five-book deal. That'll be out April 3rd. And then in April of 2013, a book called Pandemic will be out. That will be my last book with Crown.
Now you have a decision.
Now I have a decision to make. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of happy I have another year before I have to make this decision. But I have my own imprint with my business partner, A. Kovacs. We do this thing called Dark Overlord Media, where we put out...
Those are beautiful.
These.
They're just like real books.
They are real books. And we have ebook, tree book. We do audio books.
Who do you publish with?
This is us. This is, we publish.
So you don't
ourselves.
Use Lulu or Amazon?
No, we actually use R.R. Donnelly, which is a regular.
That's a real publisher.
Real publisher. Yeah. And we print 3,000 copy runs. But we're doing
Why don't you use a just-in-time printer like Lulu?
Margin's not high enough.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You make more money by printing 3,000 up front.
Yes. Yep. Well, what we're able to do, again, going back to building an audience, is I'm able to say to my audience, we're going to put out book three in this series in 8 months. Would you guys just buy it now? And then they buy it now. We pre-order. We take that capital. We're able to publish the book. So we have
You're
the money to go to a
pocket.
Real printer.
That's great.
Yeah.
And the profit margin's significantly different per
Interesting.
Book. But the decision to make will be now that there are a number of people making a living at just ebooks.
Right.
And A&I, every book we put out is available in print. It's an ebook. It's an audio book. Will we be able to sell enough of these things on our own that we don't actually need a publisher?
Right.
But publishers do a lot of really great things.
Yeah, what about editing? What about marketing? That kind of stuff mm-hmm. that a publisher provides. What do you think of the things that the publisher provides that you might not want to give up?
Well, editing is a gun-for-hire thing now. We go up for our books, for The Rookie, The Starter, and The All-Pro, we go out and we hire professional editors who go through and edit the things. And
it's the same person the publisher's
the same,
using.
The same people. Same people. We hire artists. We hire interior design. All of that same stuff. What publishers do that you can't do on your own very often is distribution. It's getting it into stores and doing that.
As we know, that doesn't matter anymore.
Doesn't really matter that
do
much
Do you
anymore.
Sell a lot of books in bookstores?
Yes. Yeah, we
so
sell a good amount.
Getting in a brick-and-mortar store is still important.
It still matters. It
so
still
that's,
matters.
A, that's a deciding point.
That's a deciding point. But if we're able to work with an independent distributor who can get the books in the stores, now the need for a publisher isn't as significant. Right. Marketing-wise and advertising-wise, it depends on if the publisher likes you at that moment. Right. Quite frankly, if you're the fair-haired boy, they'll go out and do a lot of advertising. You'll sell a lot more books than you would
have
otherwise.
The rich get richer. If you're Daniel Steele, you're going to have a book tour. You're going to have a marketing budget. Right. You don't need it.
Which is, the new Stephen King book. Does he really need subway advertising and billboards? Right. I don't think
so. But they're never going to advertise the new author Unproven.
Well, and the reason is because the margin of increase is better on a Stephen King that's going to sell a couple million. If you put the busboards out, you get a 10% increase on that. A 10% increase of 2 million instead of an unknown that maybe he's going to sell 500,000.
It's less risk. And people are risk averse. Exactly. And traditional industries like publishing industry, the more traditional they are, the more risk averse
Again, that's something else that comes full circle with people being able to do their own ebooks, put them in the Kindle store, and sell 10,000 units a month. The risk aversion of the publishers is kicking in, and now they're starting. This is the farm leagues. I thought podcasting would be the farm leagues, and I was kind of wrong, but ebooks are a major farm league. Because if you're a publisher and you have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to put out a title, it's major risk. You're going to lose money on 95% of what you put out. And then here's this guy with a science fiction story on Amazon that's been in the top 10 for 2 months. That's not much of a risk. That's already a proven
product.
He's got
an audience. Yeah. Amanda
Hawking, yeah.
Amazing story. And yet Amanda Hawking got a real publisher. So there's still, I think you're right. I think we're in that in-between time where people, partly because they grew up, you wanted as an 8-year-old writing tentacles, you wanted a publisher, gosh darn it. And I'm sure Amanda did too. But maybe the next generation won't have that dream.
Amanda made a decision where she didn't want to be hiring interior design people and editors. She just wanted to write.
She got
a big check. She now other people take care of those things for her, and she can sit and do what she loves to do. A&I, we really like the process of building a business. You know, we look around the studio and we're like, yeah, someday this would be kind of cool to start building up to this level. Yeah. And we're at a small level, but it's growing. But the hunt to build a business is part of the thrill. It's not just the writing.
Do you see this? Do you see parallels in other industries? When you look at, I mean, you have a very good perspective of where this publishing industry is going, what's going to happen to it. And there's a few inevitables out there, right? I mean, bookstores are going to become few and far between. Like you say, e-publishing is going to become much, much more important. Mm-hmm. And publishing companies are going to provide different kinds of services than they do now. Do you see the same thing in music? Do you see the same thing in video? Do you see those parallels? And how do you think publishing is reacting to the internet versus those industries?
Well, the parallels that I see primarily are, once you're in an electronic store, if your cover or your art looks good, John and Jane Public can't tell the difference. Nobody buys a book because Random House puts it out. Nobody buys a book because nobody buys a record because Sony put it out. They buy it for the author.
That's right.
So as more commerce moves online, the ability for an indie to go in and sell his own CD, instead of making now, 33 cents a CD, he's making $8 a CD. Mm-hmm. There's a drastic sea change in the ability for people to make a living doing exactly what they want to do. So those parallels run throughout all of the any industry that involves selling a product that can be sold digitally or even sold physically. What was the other part of the question?
Just as far as publishers go, you've kind of talked a little bit about how necessary they might still be. Mm-hmm. Do you think we'll need that kind of stuff in the other industries as well?
Well, you can need that kind of stuff specifically for people like Amanda Hawking, who just want someone else to do this so I can do what I want to do and make a good living at it. So they'll still be there, but I think there's a major influx of small and medium-sized publishers right now who are jumping all over the ebook concept. So the need for a publisher is going to remain to a lot of people, except there's going to be a lot more service providers out there to do that kind of thing. So it's
Real girls in the chat room.
That's her.
That's what
her.
I thought. Okay. Yeah. She's talking about your designer and stuff. And one of the things they're saying is people still judge a book by its covers. You can't stint on that. But the good news is designers, like everybody else, are out there selling their wares on the internet. And, all of this is what I love. It's democratizing. It's a free marketplace. Mm-hmm. You work with people because they're good.
But don't we need stronger legislation to stop the pirates?
Damn straight. And
Scott will be out of work, right?
This is what I love about it. I mean, it really does prove that we don't need to be all these draconian anti-piracy things. We don't, it doesn't. It's just a shame that companies are so slow to get this, but I understand they're protecting an old form of doing business that is dying. Yeah.
I'm not that sad about it because the big boys can go out there and treat their customers like criminals all they want, and it creates this giant underground marketplace, so to speak, where like A and I are just like, we will take it, give it away. If you don't want to pay for it, well, that's your choice. Maybe we'll get you next time. And it instills that sense of loyalty with the customer where people are just shocked. They're like, wait a minute, you're going to treat me like an adult and let me make up my own mind what I want to do?
I think in the long run, more and more people will actually act that way. Oh, you're not going to treat me like a thief? I'm giving you money.
Yep.
I think you're right. I think as people become more and more aware of this, that in fact, you're getting so much good. It's karma points.
Mm-hmm. That's why things like Protect IP and SOPA are so annoying. Because in the current law, somebody like you and lots of other people can just say, you know what, I'm not participating in that land of fighting against piracy. I'm going to go out here and do it my own way, and I'm going to be more successful at it. Mm-hmm. Whereas these legislations that are being proposed now from SOPA and Protect IP actually are saying, well, no, we're actually going to block websites, even if you want them. Mm-hmm. Even if you want them to spread around your free stuff, we're going to go after them and stop you from using them. And that's too far.
That's going to cut off avenues by which I can get my product out there to people. But, you know, again, the fun of owning your own small business is getting to determine we can just throw this stuff out wherever we want. Somebody's going to carry it. So.
Sometimes I wonder if we're going into a world where there are tiers and there's an underground of people like us who kind of get it and we live in our own little world. And then there's this other tier of people who don't get it and they live in their own world.
Yeah.
And these worlds don't meet. Or, and I think this is more likely the case, we're in a transitional period where these old ways and old means are going away. And this is mainstream. This is not counterculture. This is the next mainstream. That's all.
It's definitely a phase shift. It's evolution.
Yes.
And there are, you know, I'm sure you guys talk about this all the time, but there are people who are now in their earlier mid-20s who've never known a world without the internet. They've never known a world without going able to get anything that you want at any time. And these are the men and women who are going to become the captains of industry as we move forward. And as they hit into their 30s and even early 40s, then, it's
exciting.
Everything.
Isn't it?
It's really exciting.
Yeah.
Because you're able to go out and distribute your own stuff to the marketplace, you don't need to sell nearly as many copies of whatever you're doing to make a living at it.
That's important, too.
It's huge. I can sell one-tenth on our own. I can sell one-tenth of what I sell with Random House because I make about 10 times as much per book.
But you also have to accept, and I think this happens in music, too, that you won't be a platinum artist. You won't be a Danielle Steele. You're not going to make hundreds of millions of dollars. If you're a musician, you're not going to be a Metallica. You're going to make a nice living.
Mm-hmm.
And I think from a societal point of view, it's better if there's 1,000 authors making a nice living than 5 that are platinum artists.
Right.
But it does, for those who really want that platinum artist status, that's going to go away, I think.
I think it's going to go away, too. I think the great big signing bonuses from the publishers will go away, and they'll start bringing in people who are proven. And you're still going to have cultural phenomenons. You're still going to have Stephanie Myers that pop up out of nowhere that the experts can't, well, this is terrible. How can this sell? And like, her fans love it. They don't care. You're still going to get that stuff.
That's right. You're
going to have a lot more people that you've never heard of who are making a good chunk of change.
That's what I love.
I think
that's a more humane environment, really, where I want to see people like you who are great writers. I want to see great musicians who would not get signed get a chance to just make a living making their art. And that, I think that's what we hope for, I think, in this world. We've got to take a break and make a living for our art, if you don't mind.
I don't mind.
Scott Sigler is here. How many books? 9?
The 6.
6?
And Nocturnal will be actual physical print books, 6. Just audiobooks and ebooks, it's like 11.
Wow.
So, yeah.
And the podcast is at scottsigler.com. Is that the best place to go?
scottsigler.com for whatever we're podcasting live at the moment, or podiobooks.com, where my backlist is all available as free downloadable audio.
And Podiobooks is not just you now. It's other people as well?
No, Podiobooks is run by Ivo Terra and his group, and I'm not part of that, although we partner with them to get our content out. But, yeah,
they're doing a lot
over 400 free audiobooks there.
And you know what? You are the guy. Ivo should look to you and say, this is all because of Scott Sigler. Well, until you did it.
He has to give me beer.
I hope so.
We have an agreement.
I hope you're at least getting beer.
Beer for knife.
Because if you hadn't had the guts to do this in 2005, none of this would have happened.
Actually, Patio Books and Ivo, it's a huge part of what we do because we can give away one book at a time, no problem. But when we start to try and give away 10, it's complicated.
Yeah.
And Ebo runs this site where our files are all hosted there, and we're able to run pre-roll advertising against each episode.
Yeah.
Yeah, we it would be hard to do what we do without Podiobooks.com.
Yeah. Be hard to do what we do without Ford, right?
Yes. he's like, yeah, it would be impossible.
Right? It'd be impossible. Because I could tell you something. I couldn't have built this. We had to have great advertisers who help us with the podcast, a great community. They all go together, and we're just really pleased to have sponsors like Ford make these kinds of shows possible. They probably, you know, don't really know what we're doing with the money, but, you know.
You're building the Nautilus for 20,000 leagues under the sea.
Exactly.
We don't have to tell them. But I do like it. You know, actually, they do know, because Alan Mulally, who is, you know, you can always tell when these are great companies, because you'll meet the people like the CEO, the new CEO of Ford, Alan Mulally, been there a couple of years now. Came from Boeing. He was an engineer. He's a geek. He designed the 777 cockpit. He came in and he treated Ford like an engineering problem. He said, what do we need to do? And this was, of course, all the other big three automakers were in trouble. They ended up taking government loans, not Ford, because they planned, they knew, they saw what was coming. And one of the strategies that Alan implemented is turning your car into basically a 777 cockpit. Taking that automobile, which hadn't changed much since Henry Ford put the first Model Ts off the assembly line. I mean, really, the automobile was a very simple thing. You got in it and you drove there and you left the internet behind. You left the world behind. Not anymore. The amazing technology in Ford automobiles. You go to Ford.com/technology and learn about it. I'll give you an example. If you got a 2012 Ford Focus, I'm on the list for the new electric. I cannot wait. In it, you'll have sync with My Ford Touch. Now, this is great because you keep your hands on the wheel, your eyes on the road, but everything can be controlled with a little button on the steering wheel. You press the button, you talk to your car, just like Siri. You say, temperature, 73 degrees. You say, play a Johnny Cash song. You say, where am I? Where the heck am I? Where's the nearest gas station? What are the gas prices like? You can even say, what are the movie times? What are my favorite sports scores? And, I mean, the sync and Ford Touch also allow, it's got USB connectors in, it depends on the car. Some of them, it's the center, on mine, it's the center console, see, like that. You could put a 3G card in there, and now the car is wired. It's a Wi-Fi access spot, and the kids are sitting in the back seat. Up to five people at a time are online via Wi-Fi using the 3G card.
And you can stream the latest Scott Sigler book.
You could as you're going. Actually, the new app link would be great. I bet you your stuff's on Stitcher. I'm sure it's on Stitcher.
Yeah, I think we're on Stitcher.
So
yeah.
The new app link, which is the same thing, it allows. And Alan explained this. He said, we know that the phones are going to iterate faster than the cars are going to iterate. So what do? We give you the phone app developers a API. And Pandora, Stitcher, OpenBeak, you talk to them, they talk to you. So I can go, I can press the button, hands on the wheel, eyes on the road, say Stitcher, play Scott Sigler number 47, and boom, I'm listening to your book. Even if I've never downloaded it before. And that really is important for podcasters because it makes it easy for them to listen to us. There's so many great features in the Fords. Some of it's simple, like the capless fuel filler. Some of it's complex and sophisticated, like the EcoBoost engine. The key is, go to your Ford dealer and drive one today. And if not, just go to the website, Ford.com/technology, because they've got a great page with all the stuff.
We just got an Escape. I'll help your plug.
It's really awesome,
yeah,
isn't it?
We got an Escape. It's a fantastic.
You know,
car.
It's so funny because I think 10, 20 years ago, people like us would have never bought an American car, right? Oh, we got to get a Toyota or whatever the Japanese car. And you know what? These are, and because they were just really, for a while, they weren't great cars. They have really transformed the reputation of Ford. They call it polishing the blue oval. And now this is a car. I see more and more people driving Fords. And it's a great car. And you're proud you're buying an American car. And it just feels great. I am thrilled to be part of the Ford family. Phil Platt, the bad astronomer.
Yep.
He says that Ancestor is fun, creepy, and impossible to stop reading. The rare thriller that's based on cutting-edge science and is entirely possible.
Did you chain Phil when you...
No,
he was free. Okay, good.
Well, he'd been released at this
point.
He's got
that point.
He's got a tracker tag in his ear, okay. So I know where he's at. But other than that, totally free will.
Comparisons to Michael Crichton, I think very apt. Just taught thrillers. See, that's the other thing is that worked well with the podcast. It's a page turner. So, you know, you get to the end of the podcast and you have to listen to the next one.
Yep. Yeah. That really helped a lot with the first couple books that when there was no print book available. Like now we launch the podcast the day the book actually comes out because we want people to, like, I've heard four episodes of free. I can't take anymore. I got to go.
But that works too, right?
That works too. When we first came out, it was you end every episode on a cliffhanger and you make people go crazy waiting for it the next week. Now that sense of going crazy, wanting to see what happens, translates. Some people can wait, and that's great. If you can make it through all 30 episodes for free, more power to you. But a lot of people just, they need four or five episodes. They go, yes, this is what I like. I now will go buy the book knowing I'm going to have my money's going to be well spent.
Now, we've talked a lot about the thrillers. Tell us a little bit about the Galactic Football League.
Okay.
Because that's another series that you've got. The Rookie is one of that series.
Okay, what's the story?
I think the audience, if they haven't already heard about
novels?
It. Yeah.
These are the Galactic Football League is... It's a story of... It's a young adult story. But,
oh, neat.
And it's set up... We really aimed it at... a lot of people, a lot of kids don't, quote unquote, don't like to read. It's just that they're not being given anything they like.
I have to give this to my son.
He should check it out. Yeah. Hardcore sci-fi, or more importantly, a lot of kids who are into athletics and maybe don't want to read about wizards and vampires.
Yes.
Here's something they can relate to.
He would love this.
So it's a pro football league 700 years in the future. Mankind has gone to the stars, met alien races, and it's a heavy metaphor for the problems we have with racism. And the overruling race decides that we got to get these people to work together, so they kind of reinvent American football, and different races play different positions based on their physiology. So if you're going to have a winning team, you have to have all five races playing. And these aren't races where they're blue skin with something strange on their face, but they're a person. These look completely and utterly different. We got color pictures in the middle there, Leo. That's how tricked out our books are.
Wow.
Showing the different races.
Oh, look at this. Oh, this is so cool.
So,
oh, my gosh. That's so... Here we go. Here, I can put it right here. Look at this. Oh, my goodness.
So we have
fantastic
different races playing. So it's if even adults who like sci-fi and sports just eat these things up. We're on our third book. We're on the All Pro, and these are the books that A and I put out. Now this is also our small business success story. We printed 3,000 copies of this book, The Rookie, in hardcover. We're down to the last 29.
No kidding.
And when they're done, we'll figure out how to put them out in paperback. But when the hardcovers are gone, they're gone forever.
I gotta get online and buy one because I know Henry would dig this so much. And, you know, it is a real challenge to get kids to read.
Yep.
And this looks fantastic.
I think it's a challenge. It's a challenge to get them started reading. Once they get one or two, they're off to the races.
I agree. Well, I gave him Daniel Suarez's books, Demon and Freedom TM, and he loved those.
Did he?
Because they were page-turners. They're exciting. He likes sci-fi, but he loves sports, and I think he would love this
he's
even
gonna eat
better.
This up,
yeah.
A lot of Go Krakens in the chat room.
Go Krakens. We got some Kraken lovers?
Kraken fans.
You're following the quarterback. His name is Quentin Barnes, and he comes from an all-human system. And he wants to leave that. He wants to play the big time. So he has to overcome the racism that's been inbred in him through his culture. He has to join that and lead his team. And he grows. And you follow his career with the INF Krakens is there. And it's a quest. It's typical sci-fi fantasy. It's a quest story. Mm-hmm. It's a 7-book quest story. And their quest is to go out and win the championship. Instead
How
of finding
How do you come up with an idea like that? Because that's very novel.
When
aliens.
The pun.
I came up with this idea from two places. When I was in college, I was trying to come up with invent a sport to base this series on because I feel that sports doesn't get the credit it deserves at being a racially integrative factor, a major factor in Western culture. I often say that, you know, the first time a lot of white people considered a black person anything other than just a black person was Jackie Robinson.
Sure.
All of a sudden, now he's on our team. He's one of our kind. It was a major moment, and that continues to go on. So I thought, unlike the Gene Roddenberry Star Trek stories, where everybody's all happy and gets along for the most part, that when we actually meet other races, it's just going to be ugly and nasty. Yeah. And sports was a way to show that sports actually brings people together, because all you care about is winning the game and beating that other team. The other differences fade away when you're all in the same uniform. Right. And then where I finally came up with using American football, I was doing some sideline work for ESPN and in college, and I was the guy who was bringing the different teams on the field for the Michigan-Michigan State game, which is a huge, huge deal.
You're a Michigander.
A Michigander.
Yeah,
and
it's the only thing I've ever not liked about you.
we were at the big house. There's 100,000 people in Michigan Stadium, and my job is to make sure the teams come out at the right time. And my announcers and my producers in my ear saying, he was so screwing with me. I was like 19. He's like, listen, if this doesn't go right, it's going to cost ESPN $5 to $6 million.
Oh, that's horrible.
And I didn't know any better. I'm like, oh my God.
Oh, no.
So Michigan State's getting ready to come out from this side of the tunnel. Then the door to Michigan opens, and all of a sudden there's going to be this big clutch, and everybody's going to come out together. It's bad for TV. So he's in my ear, and he says, whatever you do, do not let Michigan come out. Now, I'm wrestling in college at the time at 126 pounds. And there was this guy named Greg Skrepnak, who weighed 330 pounds, was 6'9 without
Greg
the pads.
Skrep
Daddy is the captain of the team. He goes to lead the team on the field, and I had to put my hand on his chest and say, "Stop right there," because I didn't want ESPN to lose $5 million. Skrep got all confused. He's like, "Who is this tiny piece of food talking to me?"
Right.
And I managed to hold Michigan back, but that moment, I was looking at him, and my nose came up to him. I'm like, he's like a whole different species. And then everything kind of came together. I was like, I'll just use American football instead of inventing a new sport, because everybody knows at least a little bit about it, and since then it's just been wonderful. Yeah.
You like big ideas in your novels?
Yeah, there's a lot of big ideas. Like, each of the infected, ancestor, contagious, those focus, like, the big idea in here is trying to genetically engineer an organ donor animal so that instead of people dying from the organ shortage where you can't get a replacement kidney or heart because there's not enough to go around, we have a herd animal that basically has human-compatible parts in it. We just harvest them like we harvest pigs or cows, and that saves millions of lives and makes some company trillions of dollars. So that's the big idea in Ancestor.
Like that. Yeah. You, that Wikipedia says you started writing at the age of 8. Did you always know you wanted to be a writer?
Always. Nice. Always.
You didn't always know you wanted to be a podcaster.
Did not know that. I had to discover that.
Somebody asked me that the other day. Did you always know you wanted to be a podcaster? Oh,
yeah,
absolutely.
From day one.
I saw King Kong. My dad took me to see the 76 version of King Kong with Jessica Lange.
Jessica Lange, yeah.
And I was a little kid. I was 6 or 7 and sitting in that theater. And when King Kong starts banging on the big bamboo fortress, I was screaming and crying and trying to get out of the theater. And my dad's like, "No, we paid for this. You're going to stay right here." And the second I walked out of I'm literally crying as I walk out of the theater. Walk out, and I asked them, like, "When can we go see that again?" And, like, it was right there. I was 6, and I'm like, I want to be able to do that to people.
You fell in love with story.
Fell in love with story. Fell in love with the safe scare. And then the second part of it, I think I was 12 or 13, bought my mom a Stephen King book, Silver Bullet. In the process of wrapping it up for Christmas, I'm like peeking on the inside, and I read through that whole thing. Then I was done. So I knew I wanted to do something entertainment, scaring people. And then when I read my first Stephen King book, I was hooked. So I've been planning and plotting on this since I've been 12.
What was the first thing you wrote?
First story I wrote
Tentacles.
Was called There's tentacles, tentacles, and more tentacles. Yeah, which I wrote that in the third grade.
He was 8 years old.
Yeah, and I have my own drawings in there. It's horrible. I actually brought that to Dragon Con, and we videotaped me reading it for a packed house, and everybody got to listen to that. It was a lot of fun.
Do you know how lucky you are, though, that you got at that young age, you knew what you wanted to do, and that's such a powerful thing and so important, and so many people don't have that. Have known from day one.
I was lucky with that. I was lucky to have an amazing family and amazing parents. I'm like, "Yeah, I want to be a novelist." And my mom's like, "All right, let's go to the bookstore and start you reading books." And from I never once in my life heard, "Well, you know, maybe you should go into accounting."
Right. Yeah. You should not really be a doctor.
You also didn't give up, because it wasn't an immediate success or anything like that. So it takes both the desire to do it, the need to do it, but also the persistence to continue in the face of difficulty that makes it happen. And finding interesting, creative ways to make it, like making a podcast.
I had been doing everything you're supposed to do for 12 years before
That's
I discovered
a lot
podcasting.
Of dedication. Wow.
I had a goal. My goal was, I'm going to collect 100 rejection letters. Because that's the price for getting on the ride and knowing I'm serious about this.
Right.
Now I was at like 130 when I discovered podcasting.
Oh, my God.
And podcasting was just kind of a big, well, I'll show you guys. I know my stuff will resonate with people if they could just get it. But they can't get it without a publisher. I was able to podcast and give it to them, and everything's kind of
That's
taken off.
That's another lesson. You believed difference. In yourself. You, did you think you were good in the beginning, or do you believe in Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours?
Both. I not only believed I was good in the beginning, I was convinced I was the second coming of Christ in the beginning.
So you were foolishly ignorant.
Yes. I wrote I wrote this book, Infected. And
Here, hand me that, too. I want to add to my stack. This is good.
Take
You've got the Sigler collection. Yeah.
I wrote Infected, and I finished it and thought, I literally thought, like, I'm awesome at this. And then I put it away for 6 months to go do other things, and I came back and reread it. And I'm like, this is the worst thing I've ever seen in my entire life. And then gradually I've been building.
You know, I hear authors usually tell that the reverse way. They're like, I wrote it and I hated it, but then I put it away for 6 months, came back, it's like, oh, this isn't that bad. Maybe it's salvageable. But you had the opposite reaction.
I had the opposite reaction, and I just started rewriting it. I rewrote that at least 22 times from top to bottom. And now, my business partner has to deal with it all the time. I'm never happy with the books I write now. Like, I'm finishing up Nocturnal now, And it's like she's excited because I said, well, it's not the worst thing in the world, which is about the highest praise I gave myself. So
you got good enough to realize when you weren't good enough for yourself.
It's Ira Glass has that meme that's going on the
internet. I was going to ask you about that.
Oh, it's amazing. You have taste. You know your stuff is bad because you've got taste. You're not quite sure how to make it good yet. But the more work you make, your goal is to eventually get to the point where even you yourself will say, you know what, that's pretty good.
But the problem is at first, you don't live up to your taste.
Yeah.
You are terrible, and you have to somehow get through that. Fortunately, youth is stupid.
Yes.
Yes.
If I had known how bad I was for the first 20 years, I would have never
survived. Never start anything.
Yeah. You're bad at everything when you first start, and you just have to have that initiative to keep at it.
Well, there's blissful ignorance in that process. Like,
yes.
When I'm 23 and like, I'm going to become
right.
a full-time novelist, if I was to start that process now and look at 12 to 15 years of work to build to it, I'm like, that's...
How'd you support yourself?
Oh, I did. I was a reporter, and then I moved into customer support for a software company that made software for newspapers, then got into the marketing wing there. It was a company about 50, 60 people called Baseview in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and really blossomed in the marketing side of things, and then continued to do marketing for small...
It might have helped you a little
bit in
this.
It was great.
Yeah.
Continued to do marketing for small software companies, right up, and then got into a little bit of public relations, and was my last job was with Voce Communications, which is in the Bay Area, and they do a lot of communications work for tech companies.
PR,
yeah, PR specifically for bigger tech companies, and absolutely amazing place to work, amazing people. I love going to work every day, but then I got the book deal. And 6 months into that job, I had to be like, I'm
a novelist.
I hate to do this, but
bad news.
I got to focus on this if I'm going to make it big.
Smart move.
Mm-hmm.
What's your writing process? You have to write every day? You write 3 hours a day, 2 hours a day?
Try to write 3 to 4 hours a day and then move on in the morning and then try and move on to the business stuff in the afternoon. All the social media stuff, all the website work that has to be done.
That's just as much work, maybe more work than writing.
A ton of work. It never stops.
Yeah.
It never stops. Right now, because I'm under deadline, I'm a little late getting my book to Crown. My editor is waiting for it. So these have been about 12 to 14-hour days for about the last 2 weeks.
Wow.
And you just focus on that. And fortunately, I have, you know, I've got my business partner and other people in the team who can, like, fill in for you while you're doing all this stuff, and then you get that done off your plate, and then we'll go back to writing.
And of course, when you're doing something like that, you're not going to take part in something like National Novel Writing Month because you
he's
can't.
A pro. He doesn't need to.
But you are taking part in Movember.
Yes, I am.
Is that what that is?
That's
a mustache. But you've had a beard before, right?
I usually just I buy a beard trimmer and take the top off and just all around, so it's all the same height. But yeah, this lovely Bandito, I think they're calling it, is to raise money for prostate cancer research. And Movember, every year, this started in Australia, but it's spread every year. Thousands of Mo Bros and Mo Sistas are growing mustaches and bring attention to their page so that they can try and raise some money for prostate cancer.
Yeah.
So if you guys go to Movember.com and search for Scott Sigler, you'll find my page, and you can see the progress of the Stash of Evil. Hopefully it'll be bushy.
I want to do it every year, and I get so itchy by the fourth day of November that I just give them money and I give up.
Well, I already had...
You don't have to do anything.
Like, I actually trimmed, and I forgot. I was like, I should have trimmed the beard.
That's what you're supposed to do,
I know,
right?
Exactly.
You're supposed to clean, shave it clean.
Start fresh.
November 1st.
I'll shave just this clean next year.
I was getting a little worried. I was like 7 days into it. I'm like, I look like
it should
I'm
grow
15.
It's faster
terrible.
Faster than this, shouldn't it?
Yeah.
That's when I give up.
You're not watering?
That's
what you need to fertilize.
Yeah, I need to fertilize.
Hey, do we have another commercial that we need to do? All right. Is that the last one? Okay. I'm not going to do a whole commercial. Netflix. If you don't have it, get it. Netflix.com/Twitter. What do I have
Pass
to say?
Pass the URL around.
I don't have... Yeah,
Give
that's
it
the
to
main
your
thing, because I know every single one of you, not one of you doesn't have Netflix. By the way, Netflix on the Kindle Fire, nice. Nice. Now, that's $7.99 a month, and you can watch, like, thousands of movies. There's a new interface coming. It's rolled out on Android, and I'm sure it'll be here soon. That's really nice, where you see more of the Netflix streaming. If you're not a member, try it free for 30 days, Netflix.com/twit. And if you are, would you do us a little favor, just a little one, tell somebody. Just tell somebody who doesn't have Netflix, your mom, your dad, your
stranger on the street.
Stranger on the street. Shout the window, out the window. Netflix.com/twit.
I also have Netflix.
Who doesn't?
It's great. I'm trying to help
what's
you.
Your favorite, what's your favorite movie these days.
The favorite movie of all times remains Aliens. I watched. Yeah? I watched
not
that
Alien,
the sequel. Yeah,
the sequel. Aliens yeah. 2, Sigourney Weaver mm-hmm. back again. I just watched that the other night on Netflix streaming. Actually,
if you're a sci-fi horrific. Horror fan, it's a masterpiece.
We watched it. She finds the little kid, yeah. the little kid running Newt. In the yeah. Newt. Yeah.
But that I have far more influence from movies than I do from other books and other authors, and Aliens is one I watch repeatedly to get an idea of pacing and little overlapping arcs of tension. So as you're coming down on this one, the other one's starting up. Nocturnal's kind of a big. That's the one I have coming out in April, available for pre-order now. That's kind of a tribute to all the 80s movies I watched, all the 80s monster horror movies and the buddy cop movies. It's kind of a combo of all that. And it's loaded with a lot of... I take a lot of lines from all my favorite 80s movies and work them into the dialogue for the main characters. So if you're a child of the 80s, you're just going to eat that thing up.
Sounds great.
Do you read other books? A lot of authors don't read a lot of other books.
I don't. I don't have time, really. I'm writing so much and doing all this other stuff that I just don't have a lot of time to read. When I do read, it's usually if another publisher sends me a book that they're hoping to get a blurb for. Yeah. So I'll read that, hoping that if my blurb can help another author get some more sales, then that'll be great. Right. But for the most part, it's all I really have time for is Netflixing, Breaking Bad or Justified, and I watch a lot of my wife and I watch a lot of TV.
If somebody's going to start, I doubt anybody watching it doesn't already know all your works, but if somebody's going to start their first Scott Sigler book, what would be a good...
They should start with Infected.
Infected?
Yep.
That's the one to get? Okay.
And Infected, the sequel Infected is Contagious, so they can roll right into that. Ancestor is in the same... It's all in the same timeline. Everything's interrelated, even though they're not necessarily sequels. And then Pandemic will be out in 2013.
I got to ask you why you put the in the title.
Yep.
You've ruined your streak, dude. Your one-word title streak.
One-word titles.
It should just be Rookie.
It's a little different, a little bit of a differentiator for these books because these are the far future sci-fi books. But in that you're following, he's the rookie, then he's the starter, and then he moves
on. I'm buying this for Henry immediately. One of the last 30 hardcovers available at scottsigler.com. And do listen to the podcast.
For that, go to scottsigler.com/GFL.
Okay.
And then they can get right to the order there.
That's the GFL.
Mm-hmm.
Man, Scott, I you know, in the early days of podcasting, would see you every year at Podcast Expo and say hello. And, you were one of the pioneers, one of the people who really made podcasting work. So it's so great to see your success.
I'm just so excited to be here and see all of this stuff happening with this amazing studio. It's just crazy.
Yeah.
You guys must be in heaven.
crazy's the word. No, we are in heaven because this is much more fun to do shows now, like in this kind of environment as it gets dark outside.
Yeah. 4 months later, we're still here, too.
What do you mean?
We haven't been evicted? We're paying for
you
it?
Thought we'd get evicted?
I didn't think we would.
Heaven, help us.
It's
oh,
great.
My God. Scott Sigler, thank you so much. Congratulations on your continued success.
Thank
Keep
you.
Writing books. We're counting on it. And everybody should go to scottsigler.com if you don't already listen to all his stuff.
Oh, lovely.
Look at right there, that big All-Pro and GFL books. Go right there.
Yeah, nice.
That's awesome. Nice. Awesome. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you all for joining us. We always, we're not going to do triangulation next week because it's Thanksgiving week. So we'll take the day off.
So do your own triangulation at home.
Do. Find somebody interesting.
Call
Gang up on them.
Call me.
Call Scott.
I'll
interview
do another one.
Yeah.
It'll be great.
It's great. We love doing this show, though. And most Wednesdays, about 4 o'clock Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern time. That's about 1 in the morning UTC. We get together, Tom and I, and meet some great, interesting people. And we're working on some really fun people for future shows. So I hope you'll keep tuning in. If you've missed any of the episodes, we've got them online for you in audio and video form. Just go to twit.tv. And just like the Netflix thing, tell your friends. Spread the word because it's the community and the word going out from you to everybody else that makes us happy. Thank you for being here. We'll see you next time on Triangulation.